On this episode of Skeptico, well-known skeptic Dr. Michael Shermer discusses intelligent design and some alternative theories of evolution.
As long as the source is a natural source, it doesn't really matter where it comes from. Extraterrestrial intelligences have reprogrammed the genome, something like that. That's entirely possible. I mean, that's not at all original to me. That's, you know, Fred Hoyle's idea of panspermia. Or you can take some science fiction scenarios of aliens coming here and seeding on Earth. But as interesting as that would be, and it's possible, that doesn't answer the question of where those guys came from. At some point, you have to have a stepwise, bottom-up, natural, self-organized complexity out of simplicity to get those aliens or the intelligent designer or God or whoever to have stepped in the first place.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico. In this episode, we'll hear from Dr. Michael Shermer, well-known skeptic, science writer for Scientific America magazine, and he's also the founder of the Skeptic Society and the editor of its magazine, Skeptic. You'll hear me start the interview, and then I give way to Ted Dace, writer and contributor to the website Skeptical Investigations. Ted asked Dr. Shermer about his new book, Why Darwin Matters, and how some of the theories of Dr. Rupert Sheldrake might conflict with Shermer's conclusions. I'd have to say the discussion gets a little bit over my head in parts, but it's still very interesting. What I thought you might be able to do for us as an introduction, I'm sure many people know you from your many great books, your TV appearances. I used to love that show you did on Fox, by the way.
Still Exploring the Unknown, yeah.
Yeah, they still play the reruns every once in a while, and I'm always tuning in. Those are so great. But anyways, what we like to do in the show is kind of focus more on the research part of it, both the pluses and the minuses of it, you know, some of the critics of the research in parapsychology and kind of fringe science, and the people who are doing it. So since you are quite a prominent figure, could you give us a little bit of a background on how you came to that awareness, the skills and training that you have in understanding what it takes to produce high-quality research results?
Well, the standards that parapsychology are held to and should be held to are no different from anything else, any other claim in science, any science. That's just the way science is done. Although there is one proviso that, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. It's not that the standards have changed. It's just that if the standards are sloppy or some results are let through, the more extraordinary the claim, the more people are going to notice that. So if somebody's doing research to an obscure area that nobody cares about and the claims are not spectacular and mean next to nothing, then it probably, if somebody's cheating or if there's fraud or if there's error, it's probably less likely to be noticed. What happens is, I guess the analogy would be like with police work. You know, we know there's all kinds of sloppiness that goes on in police work all the time. It's just that no one ever notices until there's some big murder trial and some big celebrity hires expensive lawyers that then cull through the police reports and find all these errors, and people are shocked, like, oh my God, why did they make errors on that particular case? Well, they make errors on all of them. It's just that no one ever notices. So in that sense, then, you know, science just kind of plugs along, and there's undoubtedly lots of sloppiness in all areas of science. It's just that when an area is particularly important, like with something, a medical claim having to do with cancer research or cloning, stem cells, things that people care deeply about, that's when the sloppiness or fraud gets exposed. In the case of the paranormal research, you know, they're making some pretty spectacular claims that, if true, would really overturn, you know, the way science understands the world to be. So that's why they feel picked on, like somehow we're holding them to special standards. We're not. It's the same standards everybody else is held to. It's just that people pay closer attention because the results are pretty important, have implications.
Sure, and that makes perfectly good sense. Could you tell us a little bit just about your background or how you came to be interested in looking at this area?
Well, I've always been interested in the paranormal. I was a psych student. My undergraduate and graduate training is in experimental psychology, and in the early, mid-1970s, parapsychology was pretty popular. There was a lab at UCLA by a woman named Thelma Moss, and Uri Geller was just sort of coming onto the scene, cultural scene, and And I remember reading about some of this stuff, thinking, well, you know, maybe there's something to it. But I was just a student, and there were a number of PhD psychologists that I was training to be who believed this stuff and were writing about it. And I thought, well, you know, gosh, there must be something to it. I mean, I've just studied how rigorous these standards are, and these guys say there might be something to it. So, hey. And then I remember seeing The Amazing Randy on The Tonight Show, in which he was replicating some of these things with magic tricks. And I thought, uh-oh. You know, there's another side to this story that, you know, scientists have certain blinders on here. They can't see something else that might be going on. So that was my introduction to skepticism, as it were, and to The Amazing Randy, and also the whole concept of deception and self-deception, and how powerful a role deception, self-deception plays in our understanding of the world, and how even scientists are subject to that. They just are completely unaware of that.
Okay, great. And I think maybe as the flip side of that, and this might be a lead into your new book, Why Darwin Matters, The Case Against Intelligent Design, is sometimes there can be a shutting down of really good science. And I think, isn't that really the point that you make in how Darwin's work maybe hasn't gained as much prominence among the mass population as you would expect? Or why don't you tell us what you really...
Yeah, that's right. Within scientific circles, evolution, just the study of evolution, just is plowing along like it has for over a century now, as a rigorous science, no different from any other rigorous science. And the scientists who do it, who don't pay much attention to creationists, they don't even really notice what's going on. They're just doing their science like everybody else does. So it's really a political, cultural, social thing, and it's mainly an American thing, although there are tentacles going out from America to other countries now, where intelligent design is really getting a foothold in other countries. It's not going away with the Dover trial. That was certainly a significant blow to them legally, but that's not going to stop them. I mean, legal channels is only one of many ways you get ideas into culture. And so they have failed once again through that route, but that won't stop them. They'll continue doing their own thing. But the science ignores that. The science just goes on. The only thing where you notice it is in certain areas that are politically charged, where religious influence on politics does make a difference, like in stem cell research, for example, and the restriction of federal funding for that. But even that really doesn't matter. That's only federal funding that conservatives can try to stop. Private funding can still use it, done here in California. And it will go on in other countries, if not in America. The stem cell research won't slow up at all. It just won't be done by American scientists in public institutions that depend on government funding. It'll be done by private funding and in other countries.
I think I'd like to jump in there, Dr. Shermer, regarding your latest book, Why Darwin Matters. How do you respond to creationists who say that even if evolution could account for the variety of species, it's still a fundamentally flawed theory because it can't account for the origin of life?
Well, I mean, there's a couple answers to that. One, the origins of life research is generally thought in science to be a different topic, a different field than evolutionary biology. So hardly anybody works on the origins of life science. There's, you know, maybe a few dozen to a few hundred scientists worldwide, which is nothing. I mean, most fields have tens of thousands of scientists, you know, like the annual big neuroscience conference, you know, draws 40, 50,000 scientists. And, you know, so there's only a couple dozen really people that I can sort of think of off the top of my head who do serious science on origins of life. So part of the problem is it's kind of an isolated field. There's not that many people working on it. And it's a really hard problem to solve, really hard. It's, you know, like trying to explain consciousness and the neural correlates of consciousness in the brain. It's just hard. It doesn't mean it's insoluble. In principle, it's soluble. Definitely, it's just a hard problem to solve. So, and if anybody takes the time to learn something about it, there's a number of really good books that summarize all the research and, you know, between two covers. There's a beautiful audio course. The teaching company has, you can download it. It's you know, a college course taught by a guy named Hazen who does Origins of Life research, and it's, I think, 15, 30-minute lectures. And he summarizes all the different, like, the six major theories about how life began and the labs that are trying to test the six different theories to see which one is the right one, or maybe none of them are right, maybe there's some other theory. And so it's just that, you know, it's a fairly new science. There aren't that many people working on it. There's not much funding for it. It's a hard problem to solve. And but the problem for a creationist, what I would say, is if you hook your faith to that, like, okay, so that's where God did it. He started the whole thing off in the origins of life. Well, what are you going to do with that in, say, 10, 20, 30, 50 years when scientists have figured it out? And we now know exactly how life started on Earth. Are you going to give up your religion because you were basing it on that?
Right.
The answer is no, of course not. They won't. Believe me, they won't. But they won't, because they didn't come to those beliefs, their religious faiths, based on any kind of science in the first place. All they're doing is backing into it with after-the-fact reasoning, going, okay, this is what I already believe. Now let me go search evidence to support what I already want to believe. Everybody does that. It's just you can't do that science.
Now, have you are you familiar with Seven Clues to the Origin of Life by A.G. Karen Smith?
Yeah.
Now he states that you know, it ought to be the default assumption, if we accept evolution beyond the origin of life, it ought to be the default assumption that life originated from evolution in chemical systems in in the early Earth. So he actually says that the origin follows, is a product of evolution. So,
well, I guess it depends on how you're defining evolution. That's just a
An inorganic kind of evolution.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you want to apply that sort of Darwinian natural selection model to everything, you can apply that to universes. I mean, this is Lee Smolin's idea in his book, The Life and the Cosmos, I think it's called, where, you know, there's multiple bubble universes. Universes that have laws of nature like ours will give rise to stars, and ultimately the stars will become black holes, collapse into singularities, produce more universes, baby universes that have laws of nature like ours that give rise to stars and black holes. And, you know, in other words, they perpetuate themselves. And universes that have laws different from ours that don't give rise to stars, they won't have black holes, they won't have baby universes, and they'll go extinct. So, you know, in that sense, that sort of general evolutionary thinking can be applied to all sorts of things,
Right.
I don't have any problems with that at all.
Right. Now, I'd like to discuss Alfred Russel Wallace a little bit. You've written extensively on him, including a full-length biography in Darwin's Shadow. What do you make of the fact that Wallace promoted teleology regarding Homo sapiens, but a very rigid selectionism for all other species? Isn't there a contradiction in that?
Yeah, there is something of an odd thing there. Lots of different ideas about what was going on in his head. In my opinion, he was a hyper-selectionist. That is, he would be one of these people that Gould would call a hyper-selectionist, hyper-adaptationist, that everything natural selection does has to be done for some reason, you know, leading to some adaptation. There has to be some purpose to it. And he could not think of why selection would produce, evolution would produce such huge brains, capacity for self-awareness and mathematical reasoning and aesthetic appreciation and music and all these sorts of things you don't really need in a natural environment. I mean, a primate with a brain half the size of ours can do just fine. I mean, they do. Gorillas, chimps, orangutans, and even smaller brains, gibbons and capuchin monkeys and whatnot, they have tiny little brains. You don't really need a big brain. Big brains are expensive to run. You know, what advantages it really give you? How important is it? And so he just couldn't think of how it could have come about. And therefore, he thought there must be some intrusion of an intelligent designer. He didn't use that phrase exactly, but an intelligence into the system somehow that gave the spark of intelligence. And then also he made what I think is a reasonable argument for his time, that the chances of any of this coming about through natural forces, again on another planet, are so slim, because of all the billions of steps in evolution you have to take to get from bacteria to big brains, that, boy, there'd have to be an enormous number of planets out there for this to happen more than once. And in his time, 1903, when he wrote his book on this subject, Man's Place in the Universe, the entire cosmos was believed to be only 1,800 light years across. it's nothing. That's like a local neck of the woods in the Milky Way galaxy. But
right.
at that time, that's all they knew. That was the entire universe. So, of course, there couldn't be that many stars and planets. And therefore, we probably are alone. Therefore, chances of this happening by natural forces are slim. Therefore, there must be some built-in designed purpose to it all. And in his time, that was not an unreasonable argument to make, although Darwin certainly would have never bought it.
Now, Wallace actually wrote a book called Darwinism. I think that was back in the 90s. It was after Darwin had died. And he presented his, you know, hyper-selectionism as Darwinism.
Mm-hmm.
So did Wallace sow confusion as to Darwin's actual views?
Oh, I don't think so, because that book didn't have that much influence. If anything, it shows his own recognition of the power of Darwin's ideas. You know, the name stuck. And no, because Wallace, his torch was fading by then, I think, and his influence on evolutionary biologists, although it was important in some areas, biogeography especially, island speciation, that sort of thing, still hugely important. But that business of building in teleology to it, that's just largely ignored by scientists. So I don't think he had that much influence.
I was going to say, just in the interest of time here, we might want to jump into Dr. Shermer. We had Rupert Sheldrick, who a biologist I'm sure you're aware of.
Oh, yeah.
He was on the show recently, and he had a couple of comments that clips we wanted to play relating to Darwinism, and wanted to play those, one on Darwinism, and one,
yeah.
and get your response.
Sure.
Okay. So here goes. Here's Dr. Rupert Sheldrick.
The fact there's a real creativity inherent in nature. You can leave open the question as to whether it got into nature from a divine source or not, but there's much more to evolution than just natural selection, which weeds out organisms that don't do too well under any given set of conditions. It doesn't explain creativity in the first place. Chance mutations don't explain it very well. What explains it much better is the inherent creativity in living organisms. They're just creative. They have a creativity within them. We notice it in domestic pets, and we notice it in people. People are highly creative. And the creativity that occurs in human beings in thinking up new pieces of music, new novels, new scientific inventions, new technologies. It's not something that happens either just through random genetic mutations or through random events in the nervous system or because some intelligent designer is sort of tweaking nerves and making things happen or because of natural selection doing the creativity. There's an inherent creativity in human beings.
I'm not sure what Rupert means by creativity there, especially in animals. What do you suppose he means by creativity in animals?
I think what Sheldrick is saying is that the creativity of organisms in developing new instincts, which can then promote new bodily forms, is important in evolution rather than just relying on genetic factors to promote new bodily
right.
forms.
Right. Well, I think one good line of reasoning in response to that is the whole Evo-Devo field, which is fairly new, but really opening up our eyes about the power of the interaction between environments and genomes and how genes turn on and off depending on the environment, how certain fish, for example, they'll actually change sex depending on what other fish are in the population. If all the males are gone, some of the females will become male and vice versa. If the acidity of the water changes, they'll grow new structures or they won't, and that's done genetically but only in interaction with the environment. So the whole business of nature nurture genes are these programs that turn on or off and by themselves, this is just archaic. No one thinks like that anymore, and you can't think like that anymore. And so I think the whole business of like designing new bodies, I mean, one of the key characteristics of evolution that we learn more, discover more about the more we study it, is the incredible diversity and variation in species and how many experimental designs are tried and how few succeed. I mean, it really variation selection, boy, that variation is really important. And I think nature finds a way to be creative in that sense just by not random mutation, no, not at all, by the mixing up of genomes through sexual reproduction and especially the turning on and off of genes by the environment. And I think that's where the action is in terms of like future research over the next century or so, is really going to explain a lot of the oddities of evolution.
Well, now, if you've got a genetic mutation, this can produce a radically different bodily form. Isn't sexual recombination, allele fixing, selectively turning on or off genes, doesn't that just serve to modify the kind of changes that you would get from mutation?
Yes, but as Lynn Margulis shows with her work on the mixing and the acquisition of genomes, genomes can acquire one another and become just dramatically, overnight, hugely more complex, a gigantic leap in information content, and that produced a lot of variation.
But still, I mean, the genome that gets eaten up, so to speak, got to be where it is primarily through mutations, isn't it? I mean, radically new traits.
I think evolutionary biologists have for the longest time placed too much emphasis on random mutation. I don't think that's where the action is. I do think it's on this whole business of a genome mixing through sexual reproduction, and especially the whole Evo-Devo stuff. I think that's going to turn out to be a much greater source of diversity than mutations.
I would like to talk a little bit about the concept of non-random or directed mutations. Are you familiar with this?
Kind of.
Have you heard about that?
There's a
France-based researcher named Miroslav Hill. He conducted an experiment on mammalian cells. He divided them into two groups. One of them he exposed to a toxic chemical. And eventually the cells that were exposed developed a mutation that produced a protein that was just perfect for fighting off this toxin. And oddly enough, the sibling cells that were not exposed also immediately developed the same mutation. And Hill said, well, how are we going to explain that except that these mutations are not random?
Yeah, or a Lamarckian.
Well, you know, and of course...
Didn't somebody, maybe I'm mixing up with something else, but I thought somebody interpreted that as an example of Lamarckism. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I think Hill is trying to avoid that. He doesn't want to, get tarred with that.
Yeah.
It's interesting that Darwin himself was, Lamarckian, just in the limited sense of inheritance of acquired characteristics. In fact, the origin of species, I actually added them up. There's a whole bunch of what Darwin considers to be just clear-cut examples of inheritance of acquired traits. He talks about the period of flowering plants that are transported to different climates. They will adjust, and then their offspring, retain that adjustment. He talks about the bones of domesticated ducks that are heavier in their legs and lighter in their wings, and Darwin attributes that to the fact that they're not flying, they're just walking around, and just on and on. He lists many examples. Now, are we to assume that in every case it was, genetic mutation along with these other factors like sexual recombination that allowed these traits to get into the germline?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's still so much we don't know about the step from DNA coding for protein chains and then protein chains growing more in more complexity. The whole the proteome project, basically the equivalent of the genome project for proteins, has a long ways to go. And the fact that it turned out that our genome is really not all that different from even the simplest organisms tells us that that's not where the action is. Good to know. But the action that's going to create the difference between, say, us and chimps or us and dogs or us and plants is something to do with how proteins are formed. And I think our ignorance on that is so vast still that, caution is best advised for speculating too much.
Now, the dominant school of thought today, of course, is it's known as neo-Darwinism. Neo-Darwinism tries to assert a purely naturalistic means for the creation of the species, but it still shares a feature in common with creationism, that is, it's a kind of deterministic or mechanistic process, only without the, you know, divine mechanic in charge of it all. Instead, this process proceeds blindly through the interaction of natural selection and various genetic factors. So, isn't the mechanistic philosophy inherently stronger when it posits an intelligent mechanic as opposed to proceeding blindly? Doesn't this give creationism kind of an unfair advantage?
I guess I'd reword the question. As long as the source is a natural source, it doesn't really matter where it comes from, extraterrestrial intelligences have reprogrammed the genome, something like that. That's entirely possible. I mean, that's not at all original to me. That's, you know, Fred Hoyle's idea of panspermia, or you can take some science fiction scenarios of aliens coming here and seeding on Earth. But as interesting as that would be, and it's possible, that doesn't answer the question where those guys came from. At some point, you have to have a stepwise, bottom-up, natural, self-organized complexity out of simplicity to get those aliens or the intelligent designer or God or whoever to have stepped in the first place. So in other words, just pushes it back one step.
Of course, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, as Sheldrake was saying in that clip, you know, Darwin promoted a view that we have a struggle for survival and we make adaptations, you know, we're organisms, any kind of organism, you know, can creatively promote adaptations, and if they do benefit in that particular environmental context, then, you know, natural selection will favor them. And so we have another source besides just a mechanical process or an external deity. We have the internal creativity of the organism, and this seems, you know, to many people to be just more plausible than a mechanical process.
What does this mean, internal creativity?
Right.
Positing some sort of metaphysical thing or something. At some point, we're going to ask, well, what is this internal creativity? Quit using that word. Give us something that we can actually test in the lab. What are you talking about? Genomes? Protein chain things? What is it you're talking
about? Well, you find a challenge, you meet a challenge in your environment. We see this in human history. Civilizations are confronted with challenges, and a civilization succeeds to the extent that it, you know, creatively meets the challenge.
Or they don't, they go extinct.
Exactly.
That's usually what happens, actually.
Right. So we know that creativity... Yeah, we know that
creativity... usually just goes extinct.
Right.
It usually does not create something new. I've long used the example of polar bears as a nice example of a living transitional species between land mammals and marine mammals, something like that, but that's not correct. They're not on their way to becoming anything. Polar bears are just well adapted for doing exactly what they do. Now, because of global warming, they may change. They may become brown bears again and migrate south, or more likely, sadly, they may just go extinct. And probably that's the rule, just go extinct. But if they have some internal creativity, I mean, what does that really mean? Some of them manage to find a new way to survive, swimming longer, something like that.
And Darwin,
Darwinism.
Darwin gives an example of that in The Origin of Species. He gives the example of a bear that...
that was kind of a silly example.
Oh, you're familiar with that. He's talking about the origin of sea mammals.
The bear
swims along the stream and gradually it accustoms itself to that, and that's that would be an example of a, you know, creative adaptation.
But my point is, I don't like using woolly words like internal creativity. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's okay as a linguistic placeholder for something just for ignorance. Like when physicists or astronomers, cosmologists talk about dark energy, dark matter, that's just a linguistic place filler. Let's just call it that for now. But we really need to find what it is we're talking about here. What I find with creationists is that's where they stop. They say, well, that's the answer. No, that's not the answer. That's not any answer at all. It's just a placeholder for saying, beats me. We don't know what the hell it is. Let's just call it this until we figure it out.
Now,
so at some point I'm going to ask, well, okay, quit using that word, internal creativity, and let's look for the mechanism.
Now, what evolution demonstrates is that speciation involves spontaneous processes, and it's not under the control of any kind of centralized power, such as a deity or intelligent designer. So aren't we taking a step backward when we assume that development from the egg is under the centralized control of the genome? Aren't we, in a sense, substituting God with DNA?
I have to tell you, I think you have an agenda. I think it's a Rupert-type agenda here. This is not at all a mainstream scientific sort of question or debate. A biologist wouldn't even ask that question. It's a meaningless question, completely meaningless. It's a total unscientific question. Replacing the genome with God or God with genome, what are you talking about?
Well, I'm saying that according to the creationist view, and perhaps it's just a resemblance, not as scientifically meaningful as you would like, but we have this very kind of rigid centralized control process of development from the egg, kind of like how creationists envision the emergence of the varieties of life. But
embryology is one of the, again, another one of these areas we just don't know that much about. So rather than positing all sorts of weird, woolly ideas about this or that, maybe it's not God creationism, but some other Deepak Chopra kind of internal intelligence to the cosmos, forget all that. Just say, we don't know. Let's get back to work and figure it out. And just, it's okay to say, I don't know. Nobody knows. We have no answer to that yet. Let's just leave it on the table and go searching. And don't postulate metaphysical concepts if you don't have to.
Well, let me put it this way. If there's no design to evolution, why is there a design to development from the egg? Aren't we still clinging
to this? Who says there's no design to evolution?
Well, the evolutionists.
No, nobody says that. The word
sure, of course, everyone
loaded.
Says that.
The word is so loaded by it's been ruined by creationists that,
right.
Of course, evolution creates all sorts of designed objects. I mean, the whole Gould's whole concept of exaptation is a design concept, like the panda's thumb, for example. It's cobbled together from the parts that are available. So exaptation is an equally powerful force to adaptation. It's taking a structure that had some other purpose and using it for a new purpose. And that goes on all the time. It's just that because the word design has been sort of accepted, as you will, by creationists. Evolutionists tend to afraid to use it, so they tend to lean toward this. Oh, it just
like a blueprint or a body
by accident, something like that. Yeah. But back to the Evo Devo stuff. This is where a lot of the action is going to be for explaining embryology, for example. I mean, the egg unfolds a certain way, or parts of the genome are turned on or off depending on the maternal environment, that sort of thing. I think there's just so much we don't know there that we have a long ways to go before we, you know, populate some theory.
Is it possible that design has actually been smuggled from evolution into development in the concept of a genetic blueprint or program?
I don't know what you mean.
Let me move on. Now, Richard Dawkins, characterizes neo-Darwinian evolution as climbing Mount Improbable. Mm-hmm. As skeptics, shouldn't we doubt an explanation that entails so much improbability?
That's, again, another sort of weird question. I don't think you got Richard's analogy. It's not improbable if you take the single path up the side that spirals up slowly. There's nothing at all improbable about that. What's improbable is making the leap from the bottom to the top in one jump.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is, again, back to Sheldrake's comment about creativity, you know, and what Darwin believed, that evolution follows from a struggle for survival, and then organisms adapt to their conditions. And these adaptations, if they're useful in the environment, are encouraged by natural selection and then carried on into the next generation. You take that out and you have a mechanical process. Now all of a sudden it's a much more laborious process, a genetic process that you have to go through to get to the next level to develop a new species.
Can you give me some specific example from biology, from nature? What is it you don't understand that you'd like to solve?
Well, like, for instance, human beings have sweat glands. Now, we know that our ancestors did not have sweat glands. Was it a genetic mutation? Was it a mechanical process inside the nuclei of our cells? This would seem improbable compared to the idea that, well, we were hunting during the hottest part of the day, and it was hot, and the body responded creatively to the needs that were imposed on it.
Mm-hmm. Beats me. I don't know anything about the evolution of the sweat glands.
Well, of course, there's a million more.
Something related to that, mammary glands, breasts mm-hmm. that produce milk, those are modified sweat glands. It's a perfect example of an acceptation.
Of an acceptation, right.
Acceptation, yeah. It was used for one thing, now it's used
right.
for something
and
else.
Then,
and there's a selection for it. I mean,
that
makes perfect sense from a Darwinian
perspective. And did that originate from a purely mechanical process.
As opposed to what? What else could it be?
Ah, what else could it be? Now, see, that's what I think is...
Give me an example. What else could it be? You give me an example.
Well, there's two that I'm aware of. Miroslav Hill's concept of directed mutation, that in some way our mutations are actually responding to our life conditions.
In a prescient way, like that, you know what's coming.
Somehow, the genes of a mammalian cell, they intelligently respond. In other words, is it possible? You see, I think the reason we have this intractable debate regarding evolution is that there's got to be intelligence in there somewhere. Now, if it's not going to be an intelligent deity, shouldn't
anybody
it...
has this is not a debate in science. No one has this debate. I've never heard this debate before, and I go to all these evolution conferences. Nobody debates this. This is an outside of science debate.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Rupert Deepak Chopra kind of debate. It's a different kind of creationism, but it has nothing to do with the science. I mean, if what you say is true, polar bears should be undergoing some pretty rapid prescient genetic mutations directed toward living in warmer climates because of global warming. But they're not. They're going extinct. It's looking grim.
Well, and maybe some will survive. I mean, even in Hill's experiment, he noted that the vast majority of the cells just died, but a few picked it up. I received a promotional mailer from the Skeptic Society recently, and it was really quite excellent, so I held on to it. And I'd like to focus on the quote from Richard Feynman, the great physicist. He says, "There is no harm in doubt and skepticism, for it is through these that new discoveries are made." Now, isn't he referring specifically to doubt towards established scientific views?
Mm-hmm.
So shouldn't it be fair game for us to, go ahead and talk in ways that, establishment scientists aren't doing? Isn't Feynman saying essentially that that's what we need to do for science
sure,
to progress?
Sure, nothing wrong with that at all. But at some point, you have to come up with a way to test it, to find out whether it's true or not.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Wolfgang Pauli meant by not even wrong when he allegedly gave his insulting comment about a colleague's paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's not right. In fact, it's not even wrong. He didn't really mean that as an insult, like it's so bad it's wrong. It's not even wrong. What he meant was that this guy's not giving us any way to test it. This is the problem with string theory. That's why that book on critical string theory is called Not Even Wrong. It's that at some point, guys, you got to come up with something that we can test. Otherwise, you're just doing whatever you're doing, elegant mathematics or beautiful theorizing or whatever. All that's fine and good, but it's not really science. At some point, to be considered, part of rigorous science, you have to there has to be some way to test it, or else it's my opinion and your opinion. It's like politics. I'm a liberal, you're a Democrat, you're a conservative, and, whatever, it's my opinion, your opinion, and we all have our opinions, and so what? Well, in science, we strive for something slightly more rigorous than that, and this is the problem with string theory is undergoing right now. They're under pressure to produce something. Well, I would say the same thing to Rupert and Deepak and the other people that postulate something like a creationism, but along different lines. And that's all fine and good. Say what you want. Publish what you want. It's very interesting. I like some of Rupert's stuff. It's interesting. But at some point, and to his credit, at least he is trying to, supposedly trying to test it. those internet protocol stuff, I don't know, it's a little shaky, but at least try to test it. But it, and like the people that have tried to replicate his findings have been unable to do so, so that's not a good sign.
Well, of course, they're
hearing at the back of necks when the dogs come home, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Sheldrake does mention tests that have been that seem to reveal what he calls morphic resonance, or what the physicist Walter Alsasser called holistic memory.
Yeah, I know, but the people that replicate it, like my friend Richard Weissman, who's a world class experimentalist, who's really given it a fair shot. You know, what it really appears to be is experimenter bias, because he and Marilyn Schlitz have both tried to replicate it. She gets positive results. He gets negative results. They can't get any consistency.
Now, that would be more telepathy, right? That would be dogs know when their masters come home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't Weissman get exactly the same results that Sheldrake got in his original experiment?
No, his collaborator, Marilyn Schlitz, did, but he didn't.
Hmm.
I wrote about this in Scientific American. It looks to be an experimenter bias problem. Just talking to Weissman about this, the psychic dog stuff, he actually sat in the house with this dog, and it turns out the dog went to the window looking for its master all day long, but more in the later afternoon than the earlier, in anticipation of it. There was no pattern at all. It's just that if you don't have somebody sitting there the whole day recording it, watching it, it looks like he's anticipating when his master's coming home. But
well, now, Sheldrake has responded to that point. He says that it's simply not true, that the dog didn't do that. So I guess we're kind of stuck on that one. Now, Richard Dawkins also points out that the reason creationists just know they're right is simply that they can't imagine any other way. They can't imagine a species existing without a designer. But
good argument from personal incredulity.
Right. Now, but isn't Dawkins doing the same thing regarding the insistence on a material inheritance, and as the genome is a kind of blueprint of the body? We just, can't figure out how it could be different?
No, because he's not fully committed to that. He fully admits that the Evo Devo stuff is the hottest thing around that I've been talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Right, yeah.
And that, there's a lot we don't know. A lot of ignorance still there about how that the whole system comes about. So I don't... the only commitment any scientist, not just Dawkins, makes is that there has to be some sort of naturalistic explanation. I mean, you can use whatever word you want. There's materialism or metaphysical, naturalism, whatever. I don't care. These are just labels. What we're after is some way to test it using the stuff in the natural world that we know about. So again, saying like, well, the genome is too complex to come about by natural Darwinian forces, therefore it must have had a spark of intelligence to it. Okay, where did that, where is this intelligence? Who did this? You know, extraterrestrials from planet Vega? That if it turned out that was true, that would be really interesting. Turns out we're not alone. NASA could get more funding. Everybody would be happy at the SETI program. But it wouldn't answer our question about the origins of life on Earth. It would mm-hmm. just put it back one planet. Yeah, that's very interesting. But where did the Vegans come from? How did they get to their complexity and intelligence? Oh, well, it turns out they were created by these aliens from Andromeda, 2 billion years ago. Well, that's interesting, but where did the aliens from Andromeda come from? At some point, you got to have some sort of stepwise, natural, materialistic, whatever, force working there, right?
And isn't, the concept that previous organisms influence the development of current organisms, isn't this a potentially naturalistic view, and isn't it a view that
potentially yes, but
is testable, at least in
but what's the mechanism or whatever? See, for something like Rupert's research to get accepted, you need two things. You need first of all, you need a problem that really does need to be solved. That is it really true that people sense someone staring at them? Dogs really do know. Is that even true? Okay, let's say it turns out it is true. Okay, next step. What's the mechanism? To be accepted, fully accepted as a science, you got to have some mechanism. This is the problem Wegener had with the shifting continents, moving continents. I mean, moving continents, you got to be kidding me. What would drive a continent? I mean, it's impossible. So even though he had, a reasonable amount of evidence, mm-hmm. certainly a lot of anomalies there that could not be explained until the 1960s, when it was clear that, by God, these things are moving, really moving. And here's the mechanism that does it. These gigantic cells down below and so on. Ah, okay. Now you have acceptance. So you need both data and theory.
Right. Now, Fitzgerald does actually invoke a mechanism for,
Yeah, that's right. He does, right?
It's a field, a morphic field, and he analogizes this to the electromagnetic field that serves as the mechanism joining a transmitter and a receiver. So if that's a scientific mechanism, why wouldn't Sheldrake?
Well, because I don't think he's proved that yet. That's why now, scientists don't accept it. I don't think he's proved it.
Now, you describe yourself as a strict materialist. Is that correct?
No, I don't know.
I'm
a feminist. I'm a libertarian. Okay. I'm an atheist. I don't like any labels. What is it you want to know?
Isn't the dominant view a dualistic view, because it posits not only, material atoms, but also these abstract eternal laws that govern those atoms? So don't we already have a dualistic worldview?
But I don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean dualistic?
Well, it's two things. It's in fact, the cell biologist Stephen Rothman wrote an excellent book called Lessons from the Living Cell, he talks about reductionism, the reductionist philosophy in biology, and he says that reductionism is actually twofold. You have a micro reduction to atoms and a macro reduction to the physical laws, that governs the behavior of atoms. Mm-hmm. So if we have this twofold worldview already, why not accept the possible intrinsic reality of the mind rather than trying to reduce the mind to the brain?
Well, again, I don't like getting caught up on labels, dualism, monism, all that crap. The question is, is there something like, let's take a slightly different topic of self-organized complexity. Stuart Kaufman's research on self complex adaptive systems, and there does appear to be something sort of inherent in systems. I'm not quite sure what it is. Languages evolve a certain way, writing systems evolve, the law, the economy, marketplaces, cells, water, consciousness, these appear to be self-organized emergent properties of simpler systems. How exactly that works, we're really not sure. And I say, instead of speculating about some inherent force at work, let's just don't call it anything. Let's just keep studying it and see if we can figure out how it works and what forces are at work underneath it, driving it, that sort of thing, like economics, for example. I mean, what Adam Smith meant by the invisible hand, it's such a great metaphor, but on the other hand, it's so misleading, because it's like natural selection. You mean it almost implies somebody's doing the selecting. There's somebody in the government or in the economy is directing it. No, nobody's doing anything. It's just you and me making a living, trading. And out of that comes all this other stuff. And, you don't need any kind of metaphysical, dualistic, whatever, at work. At least, not yet, we don't.
Do you think the holistic point of view is making a comeback in terms of systems theory, complexity?
Yeah, I think I like the whole business of self-organized complexity, complex adaptive systems, chaos theory, complexity theory. I think there's much of value there, for sure, for many fields of science.
Isn't Sheldrake pretty much just trying to, give form to the holistic view with his concept of a morphic field?
I don't know. I don't know. I'd go with someone like Stuart Kaufman as somebody who's doing some pretty solid research there.
Is there any possibility that Kaufman's research could lead to a renewed understanding of creativity, creativity comes next after complexity
maybe.
In this
maybe. Although I am always somewhat skeptical of systems with directionality built into them that end up in us. A little too convenient.
Ah, well, that, of course. That takes us back to Wallace.
Well, and I liked Bob Wright's book, Zone Zero. I liked it a lot, but But the ultimate premise that, you know, history has a certain directionality that ends up in us, oh boy, that just really sends the alarms off. Like, that's just a little too convenient.
Yeah. and, you know, that's a problem throughout biology, just goal-directed behavior.
Yeah.
You know,
the Gould was so critical of all that business about the, you know, the march of progress, the ladder of life. That's why he kept pushing for the bushes metaphor rather than a ladder. And it turns out he's right in most cases. You know what? We're at 1 hour.
You can't blame me. I tried to stop it at 30 minutes and direct it in a different direction. But it was really an interesting dialogue, and I think people will find it very interesting. And
okay, that's fine.
I appreciate your time. And just really quickly, what we want to do in the podcast is to really get a real exchange going about a deeper exchange about real scientific ideas rather than just...
Oh, I think we did that.
Fantastic for you to contribute. I appreciate it. I'll send you a link and
great. All
that stuff.
Yeah, we'll post it on our webpage. That'd be great.
I'd like to thank Dr. Shermer for joining us. If you'd like more information about this episode or the podcast in general, please visit the Skeptico website. That's skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to Dr. Shermer's new book and to our previous shows. While you're at the Skeptico website, consider dropping me a note. Let me know how you like the podcast, how you think we might be able to make it better, or any other comments you might have. Finally, don't forget to tell your friends about Skeptico, blog about us, write reviews on iTunes, or anywhere else you might think to do so. We're just starting out here, but we're already beginning to generate some listeners, and that's really great. Thanks for joining us. Bye for now.